Hey, welcome back for another installment of Confident ROI. The one show you can listen to and confidently know you're going to walk away with some real return on your investment, particularly if you're a business owner, executive, or somebody who works in a business. From the man who's done all three and here to tell us about it, he's survived all of them, Alex Vorobyev. Hey, Alex.
Hello, Paul.
I'm fascinated. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of wrap up our first season here with Confident ROI. When we first met you, you were in transition. You were a longtime consultant who went and told others, hey, here's how you fix things. Here's how you get your business to the next level. And you were very well versed in a variety of tools, EOS and endless others here, assessment tools, management tools, trying to help others. And you kind of got this fascination, maybe fueled by your move up into the great Northwest there, that maybe I should try and put my money where my mouth is and try one of those things for myself. Maybe I should quit being the golf pro and go, or the golf instructor, and go out and see if I can be the golf pro. And so you started this journey, and it was fascinating week in and week out to hear you talk about how you had to discover in yourself, can I really do that role? How do I do that role? And what kind of business would I do it in? So summarize it. Talk about what you learned in that first season here of making that transition, not just geographically, but sort of mentally and professionally.
Yeah, it was a process in terms of what kind of verbs was I good at and what would be fulfilling, and kind of going down the rabbit hole without specifically knowing where it's going to go.
And you wanted to do it in a, because you're a consultant and you had trained others to do this in some process. You tried to put together a process. And one of the things I gathered is there isn't sort of an easy process. I can't Google and say, show me the career transition process. Show me the business acquisition process. There are ideas out there, but how did you come up with your process?
Well, I had actually started, I had been doing the consulting and started just strategic coach program, which works with a lot of smaller consultant groups and helping them evolve their practice. And as I went through that and they helped you kind of assess what you're good at, what you like to focus on, they use the Kolbe assessment and as part of that process.
And let's spell that out so people want to go live. It's K-O-L-B-E, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
And as I went through that process and had some time just to step back and look at things like how what I liked doing, what I didn't, and where my frustrations were, it was clear that I wasn't a good employee, and I think in some ways a consultant sometimes I get some
feels like an employee. And because I've been there, I would go in, people would bring me in. I did a lot of PR and marketing and that kind of stuff before I got into, I was in radio originally, got into PR and marketing, and then opened this station up. And I got out of consulting because they never listened to me. So you brought me in because you think I know something, and I'm going to tell you all these ideas, and one after another, you're going to say, No. I'm like, then why am I here? Or you listen, say, yep, you never do any of them. Well, neither case do I feel fulfilled. You know, I'd like you to say, if it's no, then tell me why and show me what you're going to do. Maybe I can learn from you. And if it's yes, then let's see if it works. But I didn't have that satisfaction very often.
Well, and I think from now, it being in the position I'm in now and seeing it from the other side of the lens, it's like, okay. It makes a lot more sense. even though when I ran a company before doing the consulting, I saw that perspective as well. But, you know, when you go full circle, especially it's when your own company and you've leveraged both your kidneys to do it.
Both of them, not one of them, but both of them. You have to put
on
the
line. Yeah, they wanted both. And they got a good interest rate for it.
Okay, all right.
And relatively good amortization.
I just worry about their ability to come and reclaim the equity that you've put up here. If they can reclaim those kidneys at some point in time here.
You know, it's what possessions 9/10 of the law. Right?
Okay, all right.
So we got the plan. The vision is to get one of the kidneys released from the liens here in a few years.
That's it. Right. Okay. All right.
And so we're focused on growing the business and that. But you know, overall, it's the process I went through even before looking at buying my own company and where I was evaluated all business tools, that's been really helpful because it helped me kind of figure out, you know, where do you start? Is a company I bought that's done pretty well. It had grown and it maxed out on its size for the owner, what he felt comfortable with as a company. Mm-hmm. And so he needed to implement a lot of these tools. And it was doing well, but it could do even better. And it was kind of reaching some ceilings and bottlenecks.
And let me stop you a couple, because there's a couple of key things there. So first of all, let's start by, you went internal and tried to evaluate, who am I? Okay, I guess I'm not a good employee. Did it say that you should start a business, these assessment tests that you did?
Yeah, it said, you're not a great employee. Yeah. And you're really not, you shouldn't start your own business.
Okay.
Because of the way my profile was. But it let my profile like to assess things, to figure out what to start on, but then to follow through. Typically, an entrepreneur has, in the Colby assessment, has a really high quick start. They'll start new things. You know, Elon Musk starts a lot of new things. I have a relatively high quick start, but I also have the same level follow through. Mm. And so I like to start things, but I like to follow them up. So I start a lot of projects, want to follow them up. So I drive myself a little crazy and people around me a little
too
crazy.
Too many things open, too many things going on your plate here, right?
Which going into this now, seeing a lot of opportunities to improve the business, but also kind of taking a step back and saying, all right, I can overdo it, giving myself permission to sequence them and not do everything simultaneously.
Yes.
Has been really helpful.
Now, that was one of the things I liked about being a consultant when I had a PR firm and a marketing agency. I got to work on 6 or 8 or 10 or 20 projects all at once, depending on the size of my client load and how many clients I could handle. And I found that interesting. I'm dabbling in lots of different industries. I got half a dozen open projects up, all that I found interesting and fascinating. But I didn't have to worry about, I got through the completion of that project. It was somebody else's job to carry it on, not mine. I brought it in, I implemented, I maybe did the first round of it. I got the press release written and then created the campaign and pushed it out the first time. And then I wrote off and somebody else's job was to carry it on here. So you find that you can carry it? Because I opened a bar and restaurant years ago. And I found I was really good at building bars and restaurants and getting them approved and coming up with the concept and kicking them off and getting them going. I hated the day-to-day cleaning the toilets and fixing the oven that broke and the mechanical and then filling in when the bartender wasn't there. I hated all that stuff.
Well, if you take a Colby assessment, you can see, mm-hmm. you know, those are two different profiles. Mm-hmm. And the person who likes starting restaurant concepts is much different than the person who likes to fix everything in the kitchen.
Mm, yeah,
and
right.
They're very, you know, the business I'm involved in deals a lot with fast food. And there are a lot of very successful business people who have 50, 100, hundreds of franchises.
Yeah,
where they're not coming up with a concept. All, you know, their job is to make sure that the trains run on time.
Right.
That your food is ready in 90 seconds.
Right.
Through the drive-thru. That they push through. They maximize the throughput of the store. And that that's a different skill set.
It's like a production supervisor versus the person mm-hmm. who lays out the assembly line in the beginning here. Yeah,
and you can put a person gets into that and they're that wants to be creative. You know, they're going to fight with the franchisor all the time.
Right? I want to do it this way. No, that's the way we do it, and we do it this way. You got to follow the program, follow the method.
Some people really like following rules. They like the structure. Like, hey, I don't have to question everything, and that I like to take things and keep things the way they are instead of reinventing the wheel.
So it sounds like you're somewhat in between, though. You're not starting your own business. That's what this other guy did who started mm-hmm. this business. And you're not necessarily there to just make the trains run on time and to get it as efficient as possible. That's part of it. But you're trying to tweak. You're not trying to just carry on what he did and replicate what he did. You're trying to improve it. You're trying to take it to another level, which adds another level into it. You've got to come up with some ideas that he didn't see, some systems he wasn't aware of, some procedures he hadn't put in place.
Exactly. And he had a brother that successfully grown a business that at multiples and was telling him, hey, you need to implement these things or you need to sell it.
Right.
And you know, he decided, you know, maybe I should sell it. He's still helping me with the business, which is great, but he can also focus on what he likes to do now instead of focusing on growing the business, which when you take a Colby assessment, you can see where someone who's a tech, who likes to do technical things, take things apart, put them back together, that's kind of on the other side of the spectrum of how do people and processes work?
Yeah.
How right. does, what's the big picture with the company? Where are the bottlenecks? Instead of just getting the job done, okay, what can we do? How can we look at this process and improve it for next time?
And improve it and then document it and do it again. It's the repeatability of it. I find that many startup entrepreneurs, me included probably, great coming up with ideas, passionate about it when we get into it, but it's all in our head. We do our accounting in our head. We do our processes in our head. And it becomes then a lifestyle business. If you die or leave, nobody can replicate it because it's all within you. Where the businesses that truly go to scale and get bigger and turn into multiple units. I couldn't do this with my restaurant, for example. I could never build multiple units because I couldn't systematize what we were doing. I had ideas. I had proof of concept, but I couldn't put it to paper and replicate it somewhere else if
It's easier in the heat of the moment to rely on people than to build the processes.
Right.
So a people-reliant build a business, hey, if that one person leaves, we're in trouble.
Right.
It takes extra time and effort to build in the processes, so it's not dependent on one person.
And that's what a franchise does. They give you the processes. Anybody can do if you follow the roadmap.
Dependent. A lot of times it's dependent on the owner. A lot of times the owner is the high tent pole. It's the one that can do. I just was reading about one that just closed on his 1,000th restaurant. He's got to rely. It's not all on him. You know, they're all coming to him for scheduling questions and things like that. So it's having the process there. But, you know, that takes cognitive effort to it's two things. It's emotional and it's trying to figure it out. Like, okay, well, how is the process running? How should it run? But you have the emotional aspect of it. You got to talk with people. You gotta have to be patient with them because they might not have that perspective and it's tough to get to the point of, okay, what's happening? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4 verse, and they kind of go all around in circles. That can be mentally taxing for somebody who's already working 12, 14 hours a day.
Exactly. And I'll give you a real tangible example. I'll name some names here. You know, 20 years ago, I built this bar called Kelly McHugh's. It was an Irish pub in Mission Viejo. It was very successful. It was there for 10 plus years. It was a big thing, about 5,000-6,000 square feet. We were grossing a million plus out of this thing, and mostly booze. We didn't do the food real well. And
what's the Irish breakfast or Irish meal?
What's the Irish
nutrition?
Right? Yeah, it's a 6-pack and a potato. That's an Irish 7-course meal here. And so we realized that if we were going to do another, we should build more food into it and all these things. About the same time, there was a young guy who came on our radar screen, opened up in Long Beach, a place called The Yard House. And I went and visited. Very similar to what we were doing. More food and less booze. But we all had, in these days, you know, 40 different beer handles. That was unique. And we had the screens all over the place. And we had this kind of Cheers-like atmosphere to it and everything. A giant neighborhood pub. But it was... So we both looked and felt like it could be the prototype for a chain. I could never get off the ground and go past one. He built 2 or 3. And I had him in here a couple years ago. He didn't know me at the time, but I was very aware of him. And I got to be honest, I looked at his concept and I said, ours is better. Ours is better. We have more things built into it, more elements with this Irishness. We get St. Patrick's Day and everybody thinks Irish pubs never close. And we thought we had him beat hands down. But And when I met him, I was amazed because he came out of the food and beverage industry. He wasn't a businessman. His buddies and he had been bartenders and cooks and stuff, and he had some money behind him, family money, so he opened the first one. And he never really told me how, but somehow somebody came to him and taught him, or he taught himself, how to systematize this thing. And that allowed 2, which allowed 4, which allowed 6. And when he got up to about 2 or 4... that's when the big franchisor, somebody came and bought him out and took over the concept. It was proof of concept. And I had been approached early on by some of these same people, and they went, well, talk to me when you have 2 or 3 going. and I could never get there. And it was so frustrating me. And so there's a real life example that I saw of somebody who didn't have the background. So how do you learn to process? How do you learn to systematize things? This guy, whoever you bought this business from, couldn't do it. You're going to try and do it.
It's an ongoing thing. Coming, you know, I bought the company. It's a recording. It's almost 2 months, and it's getting the team to realize that we'll have to evolve because they've been successful.
Yeah,
they've grown. They grew 65%.
We were successful. Yeah, right.
They grew 65% last year. They're like, well, why do we need to change anything?
Right.
And it's like, okay, the goal is to double. We service 2,000 locations a year.
And what do you, just roughly, what do you service them for? I don't know. Explain that.
We help them with the technology that they use to engage with their customers and measure their productivity. So
like this would be like the headphones for a drive-in or something?
Yeah, if at a drive-through, anytime when you drive up, you're talking with them. There's sophisticated communication systems there that break all the time.
All the time.
And then there's timing systems that are in the ground that are recording everything, including when you pull out early, when you leave because it's taking too long.
I didn't know that. Okay.
That data is in the cloud. It's going to the regional manager. It's going all the way to corporate. They want to know in real time which stores are struggling. And so we help them with that kind of that's productivity. We also help them with audio and video and how they're engaging with their customers on the front of the house.
So are you just an equipment vendor installing and maintaining this, or are you setting up the systems that collect the data and distribute it?
Yeah, we're helping them deploy the technology. So we sell them the technology, different OEMs. We help them integrate it. We help them look, okay, what are they trying to achieve? Which technologies are out there? Sometimes they're mandated if they're a certain type of franchisor. Right.
Certain type of headset you got to use or whatever.
And a lot of these stores are 20, 30 years old, had a lot of renovations, but not necessarily been gutted. So sometimes adding new technologies can be difficult.
I'll bet.
But it's helping them be more efficient and engage their customer more so their stores are more profitable. At the end of the day, we're trying to make stores amazing. Be it for the owner and the profitability to the person working there that, hey, they can hear easily. They can see who's in line with video. Their customers are having a good experience. And ultimately the customer, the end customer there is getting their cup of joy or bag of joy.
Cup of joy. That's what it is, yeah, really.
Or the reverse.
They're not
going to give them dopamine, right?
Or the reverse. They're not leaving pissed off. I told you off air here a couple examples just of my own life here. Driving through a Carl's Jr. near my house, I couldn't understand them. They couldn't understand me. I wanted to just get up and leave. When I pulled up, I could see the problem. The guy's multitasking and he's trying to make drinks while he's also talking to the next one in line here. All of this stuff, it's supposed to be fast.
Everyone's time crunched. You know, I didn't realize before I started looking at this business that 70 to 80% of successful fast food stores get 70 to 80% of a business of a fast food store comes from their drive-thru.
Just from their drive-thru, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was that high, but I knew it was big, yeah.
And for people, you know, I've been out there a lot now, and it's like, these people, they use it a lot. And they're one of the techs would explain to me, the better the neighborhood, the higher, when the drive-thru is not working, the more pissed they get.
It's not working, right.
And they got to go in.
I have no patience, for that stuff.
And the patience goes down, the better the neighborhood you get, the lower the patience.
Because they're under more of a time crunch. I got 400 things to do here. I can't just sit around. I'm not, let's say I'm in a retirement village or something. I got all the time in the world to wait for my coffee to come. But if I'm trying to get to a meeting I'm already 2 hours late to, I need it right now, if not sooner.
Yeah. And it's always amazing that people are late for a meeting, but they had time to stop for a certain caffeinated beverage.
Well, that's
in a certain color.
That's a whole nother discussion for me. Yeah. I don't know. We used to give coffee away in the old days to keep you around. Now they charge for it. It's a crazy world. That's their core business. So, all right. So you've taken this over. This guy built it successfully. It wasn't that it was failing and you thought you could do better. So it's already improving. But you think you could, is your goal to take it and turn it into a nationwide thing? Therefore, you got to have remote systems in place. Or do you think you can just tweak another, you can just double it again and do what he couldn't do?
That's what we're going to find out. And that's where that's what I'm working with the team on. Where are opportunities to grow? And is it geographically? Is it doing more for our current customers? The company originally got started just servicing the intercoms for drive-thrus. Mm-hmm. And now it's involved with setting up systems so that the owners can monitor all the video cameras, 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so we've been pulled into a lot of things, helping them with their POS and things like that. So it's a question of, can we do more for our core customer base?
Right.
And I see more technology coming in the fast food world because
automation and reducing labor costs.
They can't fill the positions today, so that economically they're going to have to pay more.
Right.
Or by law, they're forced to pay more, which we've always seen in Europe is if you raise the minimum wage or the effective cost of employment, there's more technology deployed.
Because if you raise the minimum wage, then I'm going to operate with a minimum number of people.
Well, it's the kiosk, right?
Right.
And the airline industry trained us to use kiosks. The kiosks are being used by some of the fast food vendors. And they're trying technology. We're working with some technology that will recognize your license plate and then access the database of, okay, you typically order a number 9 at this time of day and populate that. Hey, is that what you'd like today?
Wow. My late father, who passed away a year or two ago, used to say he hated technology and all this change. And he said it all started when those darn people got us to pump our own gas. You know, once we agreed to that, to surrender that service, then the rest were easy. So, yes, we're getting to be an automated world. And there's, like it or not, there's no going back. So as you add automation to what these were seen as these simple drive-thrus, somebody's got to install it, maintain it, and connect it together, and then collect the data. That's the other thing. How much of big data do you want to get into? We just did a show the other day about big data, and you know, we're going to have a massive amount of data available to everybody through the internet and sensors and all these things. Who's going to figure out what that means?
Well, it's really where I think our chance for growth is going to be where are the obstacles our customers are having trouble dealing with, mm-hmm. and how can we help them solve them? Now, the bigger franchisors, they guard their data pretty closely.
I'll bet.
But one of the things we're working a lot with franchisees and the big franchisors is, hey, how does the guy who has 5 McDonald's, how does he get the ability to see his cameras in real time, which the franchisor is locked down their networks because of fear of hacking.
Oh, yeah.
And so how do you solve those two competing issues? Like, hey, you don't want the credit cards hacked, so let's lock it down. But hey, how do we know what's going on and how can we track things? Because that can also, it's not just to watch the employees, but as we've seen, there's a lot of customers out there that lose it. And having the video coverage,
I hear it all the time.
It's really an insurance policy. They say, hey, here's what happened. You know, the customer went over the counter and struck the employee.
I hear this more and more. And at upscale places, a Starbucks near here, there was supposedly some customer that came in and just lost it and started punching people and hitting people over some, whatever they said was the final button that you know, the postal worker syndrome, and something makes them go postal and start shooting up the place.
And that's part of what we do is that, hey, for a lot of people, it's just like, this is the one thing in their day they didn't think was going to be a struggle to get their grande vanilla latte that they thought was going to be simple. And if that doesn't go well, you know,
I've lost it. Yeah.
And there's been stuff. People who work in these stores, they can tell you stories. I mean, people lose it.
I didn't know that, but I've heard it more and more, and that's why when you mention that. All right, so you've taken this business over, and you bought it out. Now, you don't have any background in sound equipment. You weren't an audio-visual engineer or whatever this, unless I don't know you well. Do you have any of that? Can you crawl under and connect the speakers and do any of this work if you have to? Or is that unimportant? You got people to do that and you don't need to know that.
Well, the bank asked that question. And yeah. I was a CFO back in the early 2000s for a low voltage company. And so it's a low voltage type of work. It's specialized, especially with the customer base, but had been exposed to it in that realm and learned the products and some of the technical aspects of it back then. And then my experience running a aviation maintenance company had a lot of similarities to this with technicians in the field, as well as technicians fixing equipment at our bench location, inside location. So I had enough background experience. They were willing to accept my kidneys as collateral.
Hopefully not your kid, but just your kidneys.
One of our dogs is mortgaged, but I haven't told my
your wife this
family,
yet.
So. Yeah.
All right. So because I asked it, because when I started the restaurant, everybody told me, I hadn't been in the restaurant business either, but I just decided I'm Irish, I got to own an Irish pub, and this will be fun, and oh boy, let's do it, and got some people, friends together. And it was everything but fun. All the dealing with employees is a nightmare. Dealing with regulations is a nightmare. Dealing with cities and police who watch you like a hawk because you're getting everybody drunk, that's a nightmare. You know, it was just on, and people come in, and the more fun they had, the more stuff they broke and threw up and did everything. And oh my God, I wasn't ready for any of this. But one of the lessons that they told me, and I don't know if it's true or not, is if you really want to be successful at these things, you got to know how to do it all. Doesn't mean you do it all, but you, when your employee says, I can't fix that machine, I can't get that ice thing to work, I can't possibly do these three functions at the same time, you say, watch me. I can do it all. I'm going to show you. I'm going to, and maybe by understanding, I can figure out where the roadblocks are. And I'll tell you one that just as a quick example of that. So had some trouble. I was a fanatic about keeping the bathrooms clean, particularly the women's bathroom. We're trying to get women into this upscale place. Quickly determined if the bathroom's dirty, she ain't coming back ever again, no matter how nice it looks. So I'm emphasizing to the employees over and over again, I want that bathroom spotless. And every time I showed up, I went right to the John's to check them. First thing I did. And this one manager I had it was always letting me down. It was always dirty. It was always clogged. There was always a problem there. And so finally I said to him in a meeting, I said, come on, I'm going to show you what I want. And I start to go back to clean the toilet. And I said, where's the toilet brush? And he says, you didn't tell me to buy a toilet brush. I said, that's what's been holding up the thing. Well, you told me not to spend money. You told me not to do anything. You never told, and you told me just to do what you tell me to do. I said, go get a GD toilet brush and let's deal with this. That was the issue. As stupid as that. So,
well, that's a symptom. I don't know.
I had created an atmosphere where he was afraid to go by. I had hired somebody who was a command and control guy, and I hadn't been specific enough, and I hadn't given him the feeling of authority to go and spend anything. So I had created this nightmare, and I finally discovered what the problem was, is that he didn't have a toilet brush. No wonder we couldn't clean the toilet. So is it important to know everything, or is that just old school paranoia here?
Well, there's a lot there, right?
Yeah. Managing style and everything.
Do you have to tell everyone to buy a toilet brush, or how do you articulate what's important? And
I thought I had it. I wanted clean toilets, but I didn't make it clear that to do that, I hadn't set out a process on how to clean a toilet and the tools necessary to do it and the permission to go buy them. What an awful guy I was. But, yeah, I mean, that's why I'm not in that business anymore.
Yeah, that's is it a roadblock or helping people, you know, help creating a culture like, hey, the roadblocks, here's what you can do to get around obstacles. Here's when you should be talking to me. Hey, are there conflicts? You know, having a healthy, regular dialogue that you can do that versus, you know, coming to a head of, you know, this place looks like blank again.
Crap. To literally, yeah. Well, it, as you said, there's multiple things in there. I hadn't figured out how to be a good manager. I'd created a feeling. I'd either hired somebody or created the feeling in him that he had to be a robot and just do exactly what he's told and nothing more. And I didn't really understand. I thought I was making myself clear. Go fix the toilet. And he thought he was doing that with the tools at hand. So all of those, I just... I don't know. Is it important for you to know how to crawl under and fix stuff?
Yeah, there's understanding people's personalities, right? Are they purely a rule follower?
Yeah.
Or, you know, some people are, some people aren't. In what are their buttons? What are they afraid to do? Yeah, some people just don't want to deal with it. They got right. enough in that. But if it's clear why it's important, and hey, this is important, and if we have conflicts, if you don't have the tools you need, you know, we got to talk about that.
Yeah, tell me.
There's got to be that availability.
I used to say everybody, and it never worked. I say we're not playing I Got a Secret. If you want to go back and Google that old game show, and yet I felt like I was constantly discovering things that were secrets to me. They knew, but didn't want to tell me, or wouldn't tell me, or couldn't tell me, or whatever the problem was. So I didn't know that I had to be that specific for a silly little bar. You know, you've now got technicians out in the
pretty specific, right?
Yeah, right.
Yard House is pretty specific. One of the things I looked at another business, and what I discovered in looking at the business that it serviced restaurants, Yard House has a crew come in, a separate cleaning crew come in every night and clean the entire kitchen, clean the entire restaurant. So, you know, a lot of times you have trouble with restaurant staff, right?
And I was always beating them up at the end. Yeah, they didn't want to do it.
And they're tired and it's not that great of a cleaning job.
Right.
Yard House just like, we're just going to have another crew come in. That's all they do is clean. And clean it to the level we want it cleaned at. And yard houses are generally pretty clean.
Yeah. Well, that's what this young guy, Steel Platt, somehow figured out, or the people he brought in figured out. And that's why Steel Platt's a multimillionaire and I'm not. You know, he figured out how to turn. We had similar concepts and similar success.
You know, he sold out at four, but I think it recently sold out to even a bigger group.
Oh, it's sold multiple times. And yeah, I don't know exactly what point he sold, but he built a couple of them and then he sold them. And then I think he had some position in that company and I think it sold a couple of them. It's continued to grow and go. And he set it in motion. I don't know how far he got to ride with it or carry it through, or what point he cashed out, or if he still has cashed out. But I marveled, because two neighborhood bars and restaurants, about the same size, about the same kind of profile, about the same success, one never got past one, and that was mine. And it was for some of these issues that we're talking about.
Well, did you see the founder of McDonald's?
No.
You should watch that movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right, the movie, right? Yeah.
Olive Garden bought Yard House for $585 million.
Yes, they did. Okay, all right. 500.
They dropped the Red Lobster and bought the Yard House.
Well, you know, you just made me feel worse here, because there was a day and time when old the Yard House and Kelly McHugh's were
neck and neck.
Neck and neck. Exactly. You they both were popular places and about the same kind of revenue.
But Ray,
income.
Yeah, Ray Kroc was focused on how do I scale this? Mm-hmm. Where the brothers and McDonald's were so focused on one restaurant, how to make it great. And so they were definitely, it's a different level. You know, it had different personality profiles there. And so the ability, you know, some people just could see the bigger picture and execute on that. And the conversations I have with my company is like, well, why do we have to change anything? Why do we have to even talk about this? I'm like, do you think this is going to work if we double our activity? What point between now and doubling our activity is writing on a calendar, a big, just this white calendar they carry around, our projects and when we're going to be where? And what? And we do it at... in two states, we have two offices in two states, and we do it in a number of states. At what point is that going to be overwhelmed? Just writing it in pencil when we're going to be somewhere.
Yeah.
When we have people that are all over the place and they're on their iPads and things and need to know where they're going to be
right.
and when. At some point, we're going to outgrow that, right?
Yeah, right.
And I got to keep reminding them, hey, we're not here just to maintain the status quo. Like, yeah, we're holding on. We're able to service what we have. But are we going to be able to service it for the next 20% jump?
Yeah.
Or are we going to say, well, we're just too busy?
So let's go back to your journey. So you figured out a personal assessment tool. You use things like Colby. Anything else to figure out what your strengths were and what traps you tend to step into, you know, what your management style is, all this stuff that I never thought of. I just thought it was going to be fun to build a bar. Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah, the strategic coach, they had to take Colby, and then it also had you ask ask people around you for their feedback on that. And they had some different workbooks to go through and questions and that. And I could see where, you know, my desire to get started on something and to fix something and to follow through on it, and that could be kind of it all. It didn't matter the cost on that. And also I would tend to overload the capabilities versus, because that's what I felt was necessary, versus now understanding, hey, it's much better to get one thing done than to try five things and get nothing done.
One thing done right. Exactly. All right. And what other tools are you using now to take this company to the next level? Assuming you're using EOS. You talked about that a lot, the Entrepreneur Operating System.
Yeah, I am. We'll be starting EOS here in a couple of weeks. And people in the company are asking a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And I've actually got, it took a little longer because the prices were higher than they used to be.
Ah.
They're doing quite well.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, back 2 years ago,
We had somebody from the headquarters, one of the main guys on the air the other day on Rick Franzi's show talking about that. He's become, we have two or three shows that are EOS implementers, Will, Chris, and now Rick Franzi both. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was one that was $3,500. It used to be $3,500 to $5,000 per day. They charge you on a per day, and you do kind of between 4 to 6 in your first year and then 4 afterwards. But it had gone up to $7,500. Hmm. And so I had to look around for what my company could afford and look at different styles of people. I think a lot of people don't look around. They find the system, they'll find an implementer and they want to go.
Yeah.
But I looked around and I'm excited about who we're going to be working with, and we'll have future updates on a future Confident ROI.
All right, so we throw those out. Colby, that's for personal assessments. EOS helps you implement. I think, what do they do? I've never really seen some about systems and how to have better meetings and how to have better.
The EOS?
Yeah.
EOS is, what I would boil down, is it helps you answer important questions. You know, where are you going? It's answering those big important questions that would have been really helpful when you were talking to your manager about the clean bathrooms.
Right.
It helps, you know, what's essential for this business to be successful? And what you found was clean bathrooms are absolutely essential.
I knew that for my customer, yeah.
Right. But when people know that, when people get that sense in interviews with you before they're hired, you know, while they're trained,
right,
all the time, clean bathrooms, clean bathrooms, clean bathrooms, or women aren't coming back, you start either attracting people like, yeah, hey, I get it. Yeah, that's important to me too. Or repelling people who don't have that value.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to deal with that. I don't care if it's dirty. They can deal with that. The defining the answers to those questions helps you attract and retain people who line up with those questions.
That's a good point, because we were at its core, we were kind of an Irish pub mixed with a sports bar. So a lot of sports bar stuff and a lot of sports bar bartenders and people who run and manage sports bars. Those are mostly guys. They don't care. They're sloppy. They're run down. It's cheap beer and girls with low-cut blouses. You know, that's what. And I was always fighting that until we started hiring more women. I don't know why it didn't occur to us, but as we got more women managers, the place just suddenly got cleaner because they had that instinct in them.
Careful.
I know I'm getting a little sexist here, but
we don't get you, like, you know.
But anyway, we attracted different people and got past those problems. All right, you mentioned noble sales purpose. Is that just a noble thought, or is that a real process?
No, it was a book I had come across a couple of years ago, and it was prepared by a consultant who had been a Procter & Gamble and was trying to define what made a successful sale, the most successful salespeople. And she was doing a consulting thing for a big pharmaceutical company. And she had followed around their best salesperson for a week. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't figure out, you know, what was that difference?
Yeah.
And finally, they're at the airport leaving. And the salesperson shares with them how their purpose really is to get the help doctors get the right medical, right pharmaceuticals to help their patients because of a personal family issue that the person had gone through. And it was a purpose that was driving the sales agent.
Not just a dollar.
And she started, it was an interesting thread. She started looking. And as she talked to more top performing salespeople, she found that there was a purpose driving them. It wasn't the dollar that was driving them. Dollar was important, but it wasn't the driving force. And so this book helps companies define what is your purpose? What are you doing for the, what are you helping these customers or their end customers do that gets you up in the morning? Mm-hmm. What is that noble purpose? And it's helped me to find for my company. It's like, hey, we help stores become amazing, you know, and it's how does the customer define it? And the book goes through talking about, you know, the most successful salespeople who sell with based off a purpose. They're really trying to understand what the customer's environment is, what their goals are, what they're trying to achieve, what their fears are, maybe what their boss's perception on what's important, mm-hmm. and then crafting a solution that matches that, so you can help them achieve their
goals. Does this match up with what Simon Sinek is so well known for, the videos all over YouTube that everybody's quoting all the time, the Find Your Why series?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote in the book from Simon Sinek about people will do, when people understand the why, they'll do any,
what,
you know,
they'll
more.
Do if they understand,
yeah,
the why.
And, yeah. Or I guess the other one was, where I got my quotes mixed up, but he said that, but talking about when people are financially invested, they want a return. When they're emotionally invested, they want to contribute.
Oh, ooh, I like that one.
Yeah, getting people emotionally invested in the emotional compensation element is big, especially with the millennials. And
hear it all the time. They want some purpose to what they're doing. They don't want to be a cog in a machine like we
were.
They
don't want to be like dad.
Yeah, right. That's, you know, nobody worried when I got my first job. Didn't they never come back and said, are you happy here? Yeah. They're just, get your, you're happy. You should be happy. You got a job. When my late father and I would debate in the late 60s and early 70s, what I'm going to do with my life, I say, Dad, I have to find my purpose, my passion. Who am I? I have to find myself. He said, why don't you just go find a effing job? You know, to him, it was no time to sit and worry about this. He came out of the Depression in World War II. Just get going here. And now I look behind me and in our office tower here, there's this, all sorts of ping pong tables and other things to keep the employees happy. And since they're here, just, they should be happy they have a job. No, they got to be more than that. They got to feel more connected.
Yeah, we've talked about the brain stuff, you know, yeah, that just sitting at a desk isn't inherently creative. It isn't productive. It doesn't help people to coordinate their efforts. That, you know, getting out and interacting with people, it's not a bad thing.
Well, it'll be curious to me. I hope that this is the end of this first installment. This is the long road you started here without any end in sight. That was what was interesting. If you go back and listen to this series, folks, you know, it once started with Alex trying to present his consulting practice and the various tools he believed in to others. And somewhere along the way, he said, maybe I should apply these to me. And then
was an expletive in there.
Was there? And at some point he said, maybe I should turn this around and see if I can put it into practice. I'm tired of telling others how to do it. Maybe I should put my money where my mouth is, literally, and see if I can do it. And if these tools really do work.
I put it where my kidneys are.
Yeah.
And my dog.
And your dog, right. You put all of that there.
I got the makings of, you know, it's got to be successful. Otherwise, it's really good country music song.
With has definitely has drinking involved in it, and somewhere crying in your beer somewhere here. Well, I hope you'll come back at some point in time and give us season two. This is kind of like a reality show. This is really where Alex has gone, and it's fascinating because it's a journey that many of us have taken or would like to take, but aren't sure how to take it or are afraid to take it. And Alex has jumped in with both feet into the deep end here, and you're swimming without a, you know, safety net here, whatever other analogies I can come up with there. Your dog is on the side barking, hoping that you're going to save him from drowning here. or being taken away.
There is no option.
There's no option.
There's no excuses.
Takeaways, final thoughts, other than just do it? Every entrepreneur just says, just do it at some point in time here. But you did this deliberately and carefully.
Yeah, I would say I think a lot of the business tools kind of sum up, they all in some ways teach you to be, or teach you to be deliberate, right, and to sit back and to assess it, not just in the heat of the moment when you're trying to get things done and you're trying to stay one step ahead of things, but to step back and to really assess things and decide. One of the things I had heard was deciding is when the Latin or the root of it was to kill off. Mm. And it's better to do that, taking a step back and looking at it, not close up, but a little bit far away, and allowing some time for that.
The great Faulkner, who wrote all these Southern novels, once I was fascinated by writing, took a number of classes in this, and he reportedly said the hardest part of finishing a book was knowing which one of your children to kill off. He viewed all of his characters as children. He had carefully cultivated them and written their whole story, and now it's time to cut. And
well,
that
you can always come
part.
Back with the prequel.
Right? You could, but that was that moment. I always thought, I mean, he viewed them as his children. Don't we view all these creative ideas as our child, as our dreams,
well,
as our
child? They're not children. And one of the things that went through this process, I wanted to get going once I decided to hire myself back in July of 2018. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get going, and I got close on two businesses. And I could kind of sense my wife wasn't really down with one of them that I was really close on. I wouldn't have to leverage my kidneys at all.
Mm-hmm. And one of them was a grease trap business or some crazy thing that you were looking at.
I got close to that, and I decided it didn't, the size, and I couldn't really see myself doing that, where I'm happy to do it, install. It's kind of fun to install our equipment we have and work the phones.
But you didn't want to get down, and if you had to clean out a grease trap,
Yeah. Yeah, and I haven't regretted at all walking away from those. And one of them I spent a lot of time on and a fair amount of money. And I haven't regretted either one of those, not doing them. And I haven't regretted purchasing this business once. So I think it's taking the time and being willing to walk away from something that maybe is not quite the right fit.
Yeah. Well, that's hard too, because once you've invested time and money into something, there's a momentum that sort of carries it forward here, even if you suddenly realize
that you want to finish things. And I have a profile that's like, hey, you want to finish things. I want to finish it. And it's like, this isn't one you should finish.
It's a time to...
And you and my wife call it the grease trap business, although it wasn't really grease traps. It was cleaning the frying oil.
No, okay. But it's a grease trap.
Everyone calls it the grease trap business.
It is. Well, you didn't get trapped into the grease trap business, so that's good news. Any final thoughts, words, takeaways, encouragement that you want to leave us with until we meet again?
I finance most of this by escaping California.
You can too. You can too. Well, that is true too. You know, we've had a number of people who've done that, who've, you know, obviously cost more for a variety of reasons to live here. I'd say there's a price to be paid for living in paradise, but, you know, not all of us view it that way. And there are people who are moving back into the hinterlands like you did, and taking some of that equity from their house and putting it to use for other things here.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that. I know
the less traffic.
And the less craziness and all the other stuff that goes with. All right. Well, good. Any idea when we can expect you again? Or should we just wait and wonder when you will reappear and bring us, you're going to bring us a report back?
How about they're on the holidays?
Okay. I think that'd be a good time to check in and see where you're at. And I think you will be honest. Is it what you thought? What did you discover that you didn't know you were going to discover? You know,
we're entering the J curve of it. One of my mentors had told me, there's a J curve. You go through this process. And, you know, the person I bought the business from, they hadn't made certain investments. I'm making more investments. That's inherently going to hurt the cash flow of the business.
Right. So things are going to go down before they go up. Yeah. Right.
This is the dicey time. You know, this is going to be the challenging time. And, it's looking for the payoff in the years to come.
One of the most successful podcasts over the last few years, independently produced podcasts outside of NPR, was the one that started the giant in the industry, Gimlet. They broke off from NPR, Great American Life, and started to do their own podcast. And they thought, well, what should we call it? And they called it Startup. And it was all about their journey starting up this new podcast production company, which, if it's any encouragement to you, was just sold to Spotify for $300 million. They started too about the same time I started creating podcasts. So there's a parallel here. I'm missing somehow the greater opportunity to take these things to the next level. And I hope that, like others, by listening to you, we'll all learn along the way here.
You're just comparing. Yeah, all you got to do is compare yourself to yourself, not to others.
Not to others. I like that. All right, we'll leave it there. All right, thank you, Alex Vorobyev, as we come to the end of season one of Confident ROI. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.